Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. In the words of the introduction to Tenting Tonight, Mary Roberts Rinehart, in her two trips to Glacier National Park during the early years of the 20th century, well before the park was a popular destination, offers clear evidence of her venturesome spirit. Rinehart documented these two adventures, led by dude rancher Howard Eaton of Wolf, Wyoming, in the pair of delightful travelogues, Through Glacier Park, 1916, and Tenting Tonight, 1918. Tenting Tonight also records her 1916 expedition into Washington's Cascade Range. She was born and raised in western Pennsylvania and trained as a nurse. Mary Roberts Rinehart was an improbable adventurer. At a time when most middle-class married American women rarely worked for pay, Rinehart balanced her responsibilities as a homemaker and mother, she had three active boys, with a remarkable career as one of America's most popular authors. Her plays met resounding success on Broadway. The Saturday Evening Post and other popular magazines vied for the serial rights to her novels, paying her enormous sums, and Hollywood snapped up her stories for films and often commissioned her to write the scripts. But despite her growing fame and wealth, Rinehart retained a friendly, unpretentious, and humorous voice that her audience loved and trusted. Whether she was writing about trench warfare during World War I, she spent 3 weeks on the front lines, travel in the American West, Mexico, and Europe, or the perils of breast cancer, she made challenging subjects approachable, rendering the unfamiliar familiar and guiding her readers into new worlds. Mary Roberts Rinehart was an exceptional American woman, balancing the demands of hearth and home with those of career and spectacular worldly success. She was, as her biographer notes, our first female Horatio Alger. Tenting Tonight, Chapter 1, The Trail. The trail is narrow, often but the width of the pony's feet, a tiny path that leads on and on. It is always ahead, sometimes bold and wide, as when it leads the way through the forest, often narrow as when it hugs the side of the precipice, sometimes even hiding for a time in river bottom or swamp, or covered by the debris of last winter's avalanche. Sometimes it picks its precarious way over snowfields, which hang at dizzy heights, and again it flounders through mountain streams, where the tired horses must struggle for footing and do not even dare to stoop and drink. It is dusty, it is wet, it climbs, it falls, it is beautiful and terrible. But always it skirts the coast of adventure. Always it goes on, and always it calls to those that follow it. Tiny path that it is, worn by the feet of the earth's wanderers, the path of feet in the wilderness is the onward march of life itself. City dwellers know nothing of the trail. Poor followers of the pavements, what to them is this 6-inch path of glory? Life for many of them is but a thing of avenues and streets, fixed and unmysterious, a matter of numbers and lights and postboxes and people. They know whither their streets lead. There is no surprise about them, no sudden discovery of a river to be forded, no glimpse of deer in full flight or of an eagle poised over a stream, no heights, no depths. To know if it rains at night, they look down at shining pavements. They do not hold their faces to the sky. Now I am a near city dweller. For 10 months in the year I am particular about mail delivery and eat an evening dinner and occasionally agitate the matter of having a telephone in every room of the house. I run the usual gamut of dinners, dances, and bridge with the usual country club setting as spring goes on. And each May I order a number of flimsy frocks in the conviction that I have done all the hard going I need to and that this summer we shall go to the New England coast. And then, about the 1st of June, there comes a day when I find myself going over the fishing tackle unearthed by the spring house cleaning and sorting out of inextricable confusion the family's supply of sweaters, old riding breeches, puttees, rough shoes, trout flies, quirts, ponchos, spurs, reels, and old felt hats. Some of the hats still have a few dejected flies fastened to the ribbon, melancholy hackles, sadly ruffled royal coachmen, and here and there the determined gaiety of the Parmachine bell. I look at my worn and rubbed high-laced boots, at my riding clothes, snagged with many briars and patched from many saddles, at my old brown velours hat, survival of many storms in many countries. It has been rained on in Flanders, slept on in France, and has carried many a refreshing draught to my lips in my ain country. I put my fishing rod together and give it a tentative flick across the bed, and I am lost. The family professes surprise, but it is acquiescent. And that night, or the next day, we wire that we will not take the house in Maine, and I discover that the family has never expected to go to Maine, but has been buying more trout flies right along. As a family, we are always buying trout flies. We buy a great many. I do not know what becomes of them. To those whose lives are limited to the unexciting sport of buying golf balls, which have endless names but no variety, I will explain that the trout do not eat the flies, but merely attempt to, so that one of the eternal mysteries is how our flies disappear. I have seen a junior Reinhardt start out with a boat, a rod, 6 large cakes of chocolate, and $4 worth of flies, and return a few hours later with 1 fish, 1 professor, 1 doctor, and 1 black moth minus the hook. And the boat had not upset. June, after the decision, becomes a time of subdued excitement. For fear we shall forget to pack them, things are set out early. Stringers hang from chandeliers, quirts from doorknobs. Shoe polish and disgorgers and adhesive plastic litter the dressing tables. Rows of boots line the walls. And in the evenings, those of us who are at home pore over maps and lists. This last year, our plans were ambitious. They took in 2 complete expeditions, each with our own pack outfit. The first was to take ourselves, some 8 packers, guides and cooks, and enough horses to carry our outfit, 31 in all, through the western and practically unknown side of Glacier Park in northwestern Montana to the Canadian border. If we survived that, we intended to go by rail to the Chelan country in northern Washington, and there, again with a pack train, cross the Cascades over totally unknown country to Puget Sound. We did both, to the eternal credit of our guides and horses. The family, luckily for those who have the wanderlust, is 4/5 masculine. I am the odd 5th, unlike the story of King George V and Queen Mary the other 4/5. It consists of the head of the family, to be known hereafter as the head, the big boy, the middle boy, the little boy, and myself. As the big boy is very, very big, and the little boy is not really very little, being on the verge of long trousers, we make a comfortable traveling unit. And because we were leaving the beaten path and going a-gypsying with a new camp each night, no one knew exactly where, the party gradually augmented. First, we added an optimist named Bob. Then we added a movie man, called Joe for short, because it was his name, and a still photographer, who was literally still most of the time. He did some beautiful work, but he really needed a mouth only to eat with. The movie man is unpopular with the junior members of the family just now because he hid his camera in the bushes and took the little boy in a state of goose flesh on the bank of Bowman Lake. But of course, we have not got to Bowman Lake yet. During the year before, I had ridden over the better-known trails of Glacier Park with Howard Eaton's riding party, and when I had crossed the Gunsight Pass, we had looked north and west to a great country of mountains packed with snow, with dense forests on the lower slopes and in the valley. "What is it?" I had asked the ranger who had accompanied us across the pass. "It's the west side of Glacier Park," he explained. "It is not yet opened up for tourist travel. Once or twice in a year, a camping party goes up through this part of the park. That is all." "What is it like?" I asked. "Wonderful." So, sitting there on my horse, I made up my mind that sometime I would go up the west side of Glacier Park to the Canadian border. Roughly speaking, there are at least 600 square miles of Glacier Park on the west side that are easily accessible, but that are practically unknown. Probably the area is more nearly 1,000 square miles, and this does not include the fastness of the range itself, only the slopes on the west side to the borderline of the Flathead River. The reason for the isolation of the west side of Glacier Park is easily understood. The park is divided into two halves by the Rocky Mountain Range, which traverses it from northwest to southeast. Over it, there is no single wagon road of any sort between the Canadian border and Helena, perhaps 250 miles. A railroad crosses at the Marias Pass, but from that to the Canadian line, 100 miles, travel from the east is cut off over the range, except by trail. To reach the west side of Glacier Park at the present time, the tourist, having seen the wonders of the east side, must return to Glacier Park Station, take a train over the Marias Pass, and get out at Belton. Even then, he can only go by boat up to Lewis's hotel on Lake McDonald, a trifling distance. There are no hotels beyond Lewis's and no roads. Naturally, this tremendous area is unknown and unvisited. It is being planned, however, by the new Department of National Parks to build a road this coming year along Lake Donald. Eventually, this much-needed highway will connect with the Canadian roads and thus indirectly with Banff and Lake Louise. The opening up of the west side of Glacier Park will make it perhaps the most unique of all our parks, as it is undoubtedly the most magnificent. The grandeur of the east side will be tempered by the more smiling and equally lovely western slopes. And when, between the east and the west sides, there is constructed the great motor highway, which will lead across the range, we shall have, perhaps, the most scenic motor road in the United States, until, in the fullness of time, we build another road across Cascade Pass in Washington. Chapter 2, The Big Adventure. Came at last the day to start west. In spite of warnings, we found that our irreducible minimum of luggage filled 5 wardrobe trunks. In vain, we went over our list and cast out such bulky things as extra handkerchiefs and silk socks and fancy neckties and toilet silver. We started with all 5. The sun beat in at the windows of the transcontinental train and stifled us. Over the prairies, dust blew in great clouds, covering the windowsills with white. The big boy and the middle boy and the little boy referred scornfully to the flannels and sweaters on which I had been so insistent. The head slept across the continent. The little boy counted prairie dogs. Then, almost suddenly, we were in the mountains, for the Rockies seemed to rise out of a great plain. The air was stimulating. There had been a great deal of snow last winter, and the wind from the ice-capped peaks overhead blew down and chilled us. We threw back our heads and breathed. Before going to Belton for our trip with the pack outfit, we rode again for 2 weeks with the Howard Eaton party through the east side of the park, crossing again those great passes, for each one of which, like the Indians, the traveler counts a coup, Mount Morgan, Old Piegan, under the shadow of the garden wall, Mount Henry, where the wind blows always a steady gale. We had scaled Dawson with the aid of ropes, since snowslides covered the trail, and crossed the cut bank in a hailstorm. Like the noble Duke of York, Howard Eaton had led us up a hill one day and led us down again. Only he did it every day. Once in my notebook, I wrote on top of a mountain my definition of a mountain pass. I've used it before, but because it was written with shaking fingers and was torn from my very soul, I cannot better it. This is what I wrote. A pass is a blood-curdling spot up which one's horse climbs like a goat and downside of which it slides as you lead it, trampling ever and anon on a tender part of your foot. A pass is the highest place between 2 peaks. A pass is not an opening, but a barrier which you climb with chills and descend with prayer. A pass is a thing which you try to forget at the time and which you forget about when you get back home. At last came the day when we crossed the Gunsight Pass and under Sperry Glacier looked down and across to the north and west. It was sunset and cold. The day had been a long and trying one. We had ridden across an ice field which sloped gently off into China, I dare say. I did not look over. Our horses were weary, and we were saddle-sore and hungry. Pete, our big guide, whose name was really not Pete at all, waved an airy hand toward the massed peaks beyond, the land of our dreams. "Well," he said, "there it is." And there it was. Getting a pack outfit ready for a long trip into the wilderness is a serious matter. We were taking 31 horses, guides, packers, and a cook. But we were doing more than that. We were taking 2 boats. This was Bob's idea. Any highly original idea, such as taking boats where not even tourists had gone before, or putting eggs on a bucking horse, or carrying grapefruit for breakfast into the wilderness was Bob's idea. "You see, I figure it out like this," he said, when, on our arrival at Belton, we found the boats among our equipment. "If we can get these boats up to the Canadian line and come down the Flathead Rapids all the way, it'll only take about 4 days on the river. It's a stunt that's never been pulled off." "Do you mean," I said, "that we are going to run 4 days of rapids that have never been run?" "That's it." I looked around. There in a group were the head, the big boy, and the middle boy, and the little boy, and a fortune teller in Atlantic City had told me to beware of water. "At the worst places," the optimist continued, "we can send Joe ahead in one boat with the movie outfit and get you as you come along." "I dare say," I observed with some bitterness. "Of course we may upset, but if we do, I'll try to go down for the third time in front of the camera." But even then the boats were being hoisted into a wagon bed filled with hay, and I knew that I was going to run 4 days of rapids. It was written. It was a bright morning. In a corral, the horses were waiting to be packed. Rolls of blankets, crates of food, and camping utensils lay everywhere. The big boy marshaled the fishing tackle. Bill, the cook, was searching the town for the top of an old stove to bake on. We had provided 2 reflector ovens, but he regarded them with suspicion. They would not, he suspected, do justice to his specialty, the cornmeal saddlebag, a sort of sublimated hot cake. I strolled to the corral and cast a horsewoman's eye on my mount. "He looks like a very nice horse," I said. "He's quite handsome." Pete tightened up the cinch. "Yes," he observed, "he's all right. He's a pretty good mare." The head was wandering around with lists in his hand. His conversation ran something like this: pocket flashes, chocolate, jam, medicine case, reels, landing nets, cigarettes, tooth powder, slickers, matches. He was always accumulating matches. One moment a box of matches would be in plain sight, and the next it had disappeared. He became a sort of match magazine, so that if anybody had struck him violently, in almost any spot, he would have exploded. Hours went by. The sun was getting high and hot. The crowd which had been watching gradually disappeared about its business. The 2 boats, big sturdy river boats they were, had rumbled along toward the wilderness, one on top of the other, with George Locke and Mike Shannon as pilots, watching for breakers ahead. In the corral, our supplies were being packed on the horses. Bill Shea and Pete, Tom Sullivan and Tom Farmer, and their assistants working against time. In crates were our cooking utensils: ham, bacon, canned salmon, jam, flour, cornmeal, eggs, baking powder, flies, rods and reels, reflector ovens, sunburn lotion, cocoa, coffee, and so on. Cocoa is the cowboy's friend. Innumerable blankets, tarp beds, and war sacks laid rolled ready for the pack saddles. The cook was declaiming loudly that someone had opened his pack and taken out his cleaver. For a pack outfit, the west side of Glacier Park is ideal. The east side is much the best so far for those who wish to make short trips along the trails into the mountains, although as yet only a small part, comparatively, of the eastern wonderland is open. There one may spend a day or several days in the midst of the wildest possible country and yet return at night to excellent hotels. On the west side, however, a pack outfit is necessary. There is but one hotel, Lewis's on Lake McDonald. To get to the Canadian line, there must be camping facilities if there are no stopovers. And not to stop over is to lose the joy of the trip. It is an ideal 2 or 3 weeks' jaunt with a pack train. A woman who can sit a horse, and everyone can ride in a western saddle, a woman can make the land trip not only with comfort but with joy. That is, a woman who likes the outdoors. What did we wear that bright morning when, all ready at last, the cook on the chuck wagon, the boats ambling ahead, with Bill Hossack, the teamster, driving the long line of heavily packed horses and our own saddlers lined up for the adventure, we moved out on the trail. Well, the men wore khaki riding trousers and flannel shirts, broad-brimmed felt hats, army socks drawn up over the cuff of the breeches, and pack shoes. A pack shoe is one in which the leather of the upper part makes the sole also, without a seam. Onto this soft sole is sewed a heavy leather one. The pack shoe has a fastened tongue and is waterproof. And I? I had not counted on the movie man, and I was dressed for comfort in the woods. I had buckskin riding breeches and high boots, and over my thin riding shirt I wore a cloth coat. I had packed in my war bag a divided skirt also, and a linen skirt for hot days, and breeches and coat, but of this latter the least said the better. It betrayed me, and in portions deserted me. All of us carried 10 drinking cups which vied with the bells on the pack animals for jingle. Most of us had sweaters or leather windjammers. The guides wore chaps of many colors, boots with high heels which put our practical packs in the shade, and gay silk handkerchiefs. Joe was to be a detachable unit. As a matter of fact, he became detached rather early in the game, having been accidentally given a bucker. It was on the second day, I think, that his horse buried his head between his forelegs and dramatized one of the best bits of the trip when Joe was totally unable to photograph it. He had his own guide and extra horse for the camera. It had been our expectation that at the most hazardous parts of the journey, he would perch on some crag and show us courageously risking our necks to have a good time. But on the really bad places, he had his own life to save, and he never really fully trusted Maud, I think, after the first day. Maud was his horse. Besides, when he did climb to some eyrie to photograph me, for instance, in a sort of Napoleon crossing the Alps attitude, sitting my horse on the brink of eternity and being reassured from safety by the optimist, outside the picture, of course, the developed film flattened out the landscape, so that although I was on the edge of a canyon a mile deep, I might as well have been posing on the bank of the Ohio River. On the east side of the park, I had ridden Highball. It is not particularly significant that I started the summer on Highball and ended it on Budweiser. Now I had Angel, a huge white mare with a pink nose, a loving disposition, and a gait that kept me swallowing my tongue for fear I would bite the end off it. The little boy had Prince, a small pony which ran exactly like an Airedale dog, and in every canter beat out the entire string. One bronco was called Bronchitis. The top horse of the string was Bill Shea's Dynamite, according to Bill Shea. There were Dusty, Shorty, Sally Goodwin, Buffalo Tom, Chalkeye, Comet, and Swapping Tater being a pacer who, when he hit the ground, swapped feet. Bob had Sister Sarah. At last everything was ready. The pack train got slowly underway. We leaped into our saddles, leaped being a figurative term which grew more and more figurative as time went on and we grew saddle-weary and stiff, and passing the pack train on a canter, led off for the wilderness. All that first day we rode, now in the sun, now in deep forest. Luncheon time came, but the pack train was far behind. We waited, but we could not hear so much as the tinkle of the bells. So we munched cakes of chocolate from the pockets of our riding coats and went grimly on. The wagon with the boats had made good time. It was several miles along the wagon trail before we caught up with it. It had found a quiet harbor beside the road, and the boatmen were demanding food. We tossed them what was left of the chocolate and went on. The presence of a wagon trail in that empty land, unvisited and unknown, requires explanation. In the first place, it was not really a road. It was a trail, and in places barely that. But 16 years before, a road had been cleared through the forest by some people who believed there was oil near the Canadian line. They cut down trees and built corduroy bridges. But in 16 years, no wheels have worn it smooth. It takes its leisurely way, now through wilderness, now through burnt country, where the trees stand stark and dead, now through prairie or creek bottom, now up, now down, always with the range riding abruptly to the east and the Flathead River somewhere to the west. It will not take much expenditure to make that old wagon trail into a good road. It has its faults. It goes down steep slopes. On the second day out, the chuck wagon got away, and fetching up at the bottom, threw out Bill the cook and nearly broke his neck. It climbs like a cat after a young robin. It is rocky or muddy or both, but it is, potentially, a road. The Rocky Mountains run northwest and southeast, and in numerous basins, fed by melting glaciers and snowfields, are deep and quiet lakes. These lakes on the west side discharge their overflow through roaring and precipitous streams to the Flathead, which flows south and east. While our general direction was north, it was our intention to turn off east and camp at the different lakes, coming back again to the wagon trail to resume our journey. Therefore, it became necessary, day after day, to take our boats off the wagon road and haul them along foot trails none too good. The log of the two boats is in itself a thrilling story. There were days and days when the wagon was mired, when it stuck in the fords of streams or in soft places on the trail. It was a land flotilla by day, and with its straw, a couch at night. And there came, toward the end of the journey, that one nerve-wracking day when over a 60-foot cliff down a foot trail, it was necessary to rope wagon, boats, and all to get the boats into the Flathead. But all this was before us then. We only knew it was summer, and the days were warm and the nights cool, and that the streams were full of trout, that such things as telegraphs and telephones were falling far in our rear, and that before us was the big adventure. I'm Cheryl Ann Millsap. I've been reading from Tenting Tonight by Mary Roberts Rinehart, which was republished in 2002 by Riverbend Publishing, Helena, Montana, in cooperation with the Montana Historical Society. Bookshelf is a feature of Spokane Public Radio. Vern Windham and Nancy Roth, executive producers, producer Caitlin Maroney.